This is Chapter a Day. I'm Susan Sweeney. We're reading The Tiger's Wife, Taya Obritz's 2011 novel. The story takes place in an unnamed Balkan country recovering from a long war. The novel's central character is Natalia, a young doctor who has just learned that her grandfather has died. The novel moves back and forth between the past and the present day as Natalia sorts through memories of her grandfather and comes to understand the depth of the loss. She comes back again and again to one of her grandfather's most dramatic stories. In 1941, the Germans bombed the city, during which event the tiger escaped from the zoo and found its way into the countryside near Galina, her grandfather's childhood home, striking terror into the hearts of the villagers. The pregnant, deaf-mute wife of Luca, the town butcher, seems to be feeding and spending time with the tiger during the nights. And now, Luca has disappeared. The villagers begin calling the deaf-mute the tiger's wife. But Darisha, the bear killer, has just arrived in town, which everyone knows means the tiger's days are numbered. The Tiger's Wife, Chapter 13. Over the years, as times grew harder, Darisha found himself hunting specific bears, problem bears. Stories of his prowess had spread, and messengers would scour the woods to find him. A black Bruin had made off with somebody's child in Zlatica. An unseen devil bear was coming down to a farm in Drveno, slaughtering horses in the field. A red sow the size of a house had lost her cubs to a male bear in Yesenitsa and was jealously guarding the cornfield in which they had died, attacking the farmers during harvest. An old gray boar had made a lair for himself in a barn in Preliv and was hibernating in there. One by one, he found them all, and when the killing was done, he took their hides with him to the next village. The villagers would welcome him and take him in, feed and clothe him, buy the pelts he did not keep for himself. And then, when the time came for him to help them too, they would line up in awe along the village streets and watch him leave the village for the forest beyond. Whether or not Darisha took the precaution of burying his weapons somewhere in the forest is irrelevant. Suffice it to say that he made an impressive sight, all 5'7" of him, disappearing into the forest unarmed, with the great bear pelt rolling over his shoulders. And now, a tiger. It is said, of course, that Darisha interfered on Galina's behalf as soon as he heard of the villager's misfortune. The truth, however, is that Darisha had little interest in hunting a tiger in the bitter winter. He was already in his late 40s by then, reluctant to tangle with the unfamiliar. And besides, he knew the war was coming closer, sensed it in the stories he'd heard along the road. He was not compelled to stay in this part of the mountains, with the troops moving quickly through the foothills, ready to come up at the first hint of spring. And though his refusal to the priest was firm, it was the apothecary who finally convinced him to stay. The apothecary who appealed to Darisha's sense of compassion, not through righteousness or desperation or even the novelty of the quarry. It was well known that Darisha, during his stays in the village, was content to sit in the square, sharpening his knives and eavesdropping on the breathless, well-side conversations of women, or to tease them in the marketplace where they stood cross-armed behind their stands, eyes alert and unwavering. Darisha's affection for women extended to an intolerance of the things that harmed or humiliated them. Loud men, loutish behavior, unwanted advances. He was notorious wherever he went for dislocating the shoulders of aggressive drunks or pulling the ears of neighborhood boys who stood about whistling at young women coming back from the pasture. So, at daybreak, the apothecary took him to the edge of the forest on the pretense of showing him the tiger's tracks. "At least come see what we got on our hands," he said, "and tell me what you think of it." The two of them knelt over the previous night's paw prints, and Darisha marveled at the size of them, the strong and unhesitating track that wound up the mountain and into the trees. Darisha climbed into the bracken to look for urine and traces of the tiger's fur snagged on the low-hanging thickets. And when he came back, they followed the tiger's trail back to the village, to the pasture, and over the fence. It led them, of course, to the butcher's house. And the tiger's wife came to the doorway and watched them pass by. She was already obviously pregnant, but something, perhaps the pregnancy itself, or Luca's absence, or something else entirely, had made her come into grace. Darisha took off his hat when he saw her and kept it folded in his hands while the tiger's wife studied him with flat eyes. The apothecary took Darisha's arm. "That tiger seems to have taken a liking to her," he said, "which worries me. She lives alone." He did not call her the tiger's wife, and he did not mention the liking she herself seemed to have taken to the tiger.
"Isn't that the butcher's wife?" Darisha asked.
"His widow," the apothecary told him, "recently widowed." Nothing about the story indicates that Darisha had any other reaction to the girl, but because he agreed, later that afternoon, to stay a while and see what could be done about the tiger, people say he was a little in love with her. He was a little in love with her while he walked the woods at the bottom of the mountain, reading signs of the tiger in the snow, and a little in love with her as he opened the jaws of bear traps along the fence where the tiger would come through. He was a little in love with her that second morning when he went out to check the traps and found them closed empty, shut over nothing, slammed down over dead air. A little in love with her when he made an announcement to the whole village that he could work only with everyone's cooperation and that none of the children must go near the traps again because this time they might not be so lucky, might lose an arm or a leg to the iron jaws. With gossip blazing through the village, what was this new sorcery? How could the traps have closed on their own with nothing to set them off? No one dared tell Darisha what they really thought. She had done it herself, the tiger's wife. Their fears, to them, seemed smaller with Darisha there, shameful to bring up to him. So the girl's magic was allowed to lie over the pasture, the village, probably the entire mountain. Nothing could undo it. Later that afternoon, Mother Vera pulled my grandfather's ear and demanded,
"Did you do it, boy? Did you go to the traps last night?"
"I did not," he said sharply. And he hadn't. He had, however, explained Darisha's efforts to the tiger's wife in the ash of the hearth, and spent a sleepless night praying that the tiger would not blunder into the traps, going to the window to look out over the empty streets in the moonlight. Mother Vera's insistence that he stay out of it did not prevent him from taking advantage of Darisha's tolerance of children, tailing the bear as he went about his work. It did not prevent my grandfather from sitting innocently on a nearby tree stump while Darisha prepared bait carcasses, asking 1,000 questions about the hunt. It did not prevent him from following Darisha out to the pasture, and then, as the days went on, to the edge of the woods, to the lowest bank of the forest, and puzzling over the sight of the empty traps. When the tracks disappeared from the pasture altogether, the apothecary knew that the tiger's wife was responsible in some capacity for Darisha's lack of success. With this in mind, he did his best to steer the bear away from revealing too many of his plans to my grandfather. "Of course, he doesn't want you to kill it," he said to the bear one evening.
"I'll let him keep one of the teeth when it's done," Darisha said, smiling. "That always helps."
The tiger, it seemed, had disappeared from the village. This forced Darisha to hunt deeper in the woods, and after that came things that are difficult to explain. His snares, they say, were always full of crows. Crows already dead, their wings stiff against their sides, and the bait untouched. Darisha's traps were spread out and well hidden, and she found them all, found them night after night, filling them with dead birds. How could she, small as she was, carrying the added weight of her belly, make that nightly journey, covering her own tracks, covering the tiger's? How could she bury each poisoned carcass Darisha left out? Not rabbits or squirrels, but deer, sheep, boar, so that no trace of it could be found in the morning. When Darisha, growing frustrated, set a pit trap over a frozen stream bed, how could she break the trap herself and leave, in place of the twigs and ropes, a worn blanket thrust down over the tip of the spear? How could she do all this and come back to the village unbruised, unharmed, her eyes full of innocence, and watch the villagers pretend not to know it was her? I cannot explain any of it, but the baker's daughter thought she could. Unable to restrain herself, she stopped Darisha one evening in the street and held on to his arms as she told him all about the blacksmith, about Luca and the baby. "People have seen it," she said, her eyes full of tears. "The tiger is her husband. He comes into her house each night and takes off his skin. That apothecary, he knows, but he will not tell you this. He's not from here." I cannot say whether or not Darisha believed this, but he was a practical man, and he was aware of his own tendency to prey, through his reputation, on the superstitions of the people of Galina. It did not surprise him to learn that the villagers had hatched a theory of their own, but he realized then that the apothecary had taken advantage of him, that he had led Darisha to protect the girl above all the others, without presenting the possibility that she did not want his protection. He'd been suspicious of deliberate sabotage for some time, and he was a fool for ignoring the signs. That night Darisha flew into a rage. "You've lied to me," he shouted. "There's far more to this than you've led me to believe." "Why would I tell you village stories?" the apothecary demanded, holding his ground between Darisha and the ibis in the cage. "What are they besides superstitions? How could listening to this nonsense have helped you?" Nevertheless, that night, Darisha sat at the window of the shop, and the apothecary, for better or for worse, was forced to keep him company. They sat in silence for hours, watching the village street and the distant square of light in the window of the butcher's house. But for all his years as a hunter, the countless vigils he had learned to endure, Darisha found himself falling into dreams that made no sense to him, dreams in which he stood at the front of the house of the tiger's wife and watched the return of her husband. He would see the tiger, broad-shouldered, red skin glinting in the moonlight, cross the square and come down the road, the night behind him drawing in like the hem of a dress. The door of the butcher's house would open, and then, through the window, Darisha could see the tiger rise upright and embrace the girl, and the two of them would sit down at the table together to eat. And always they were eating heads, the heads of cattle and sheep and deer, and then they ate the head of the hermaphroditic goat from the pasha's trophy room. The villagers were not surprised to find Darisha preparing to leave the following morning, and they stood out in the snow, silent and pale, while he rolled up his carpet and piled the remaining pelts onto his cart without looking at any of them. They were not surprised, but they were angry. He had been their surest line of defense, the last reliable weapon they'd been able to offer up against the tiger, and the girl's magic had proved too powerful even for him. They were alone now, with the tiger and his wife. Alone again. For good. The tiger had been in the thickets above the ruined monastery for days, his ears straining for the faint sound of the hunter setting traps along the bottom of the hill. Obvious to him, now that he recognized the sound and smell of them. He had not come close enough to determine what they did. She had brought him here, walked with him patiently, with her hand on the ridge between his shoulders, the meat she'd brought him hidden somewhere inside her coat. He had gone a week without the warmth of the village and the smokehouse smell of her hair, though he had found faint traces of her in the air now and then, almost always at night. Once or twice he had gone to her, had tracked her down in the blackness of the trees, but she had always led him back. And so he had lain there, among the ruins of Sveti Danilo, while the snow fell through the caved-in roof above the altar, and watched the birds huddle along the golden arch of the altarpiece. He did not fear the hunter, because he did not know how or why he should. He knew only that the smell that clung to this man was different, a cluttered smell, the smell of earth and heavy rot, of possessions over which death had been repeatedly smeared. And he found that that did not invite him. It did not invite him when he watched the man from his clearing from the ridge, or when he found it around his old hiding places, along paths he had walked the day before. It was not the hunter's smell, but the scent of a badger, unsteady and warm with winter sleep, that he followed down from Sveti Danilo the day he came across the ox cart, hidden in the pine grove. The tiger had come up from behind, upwind of the cart, and the surprising shape, the sheer size of the cart, had pulled him down onto his belly. Crouching behind it, he could see beyond the bracken to where the wheels had sunk into the snow and to where the oxen stood, half-blind with hair, flank to flank for warmth, their breath curling out. The smell of the hunter was everywhere. The tiger lay in the black thicket behind the wagon for a long time, waiting for something, something just out of reach of his understanding of the situation. Then the wind turned, and the oxen got his scent, and they began to shift nervously, their harnesses clanking, the chains that yoked them to the wagon shuddering with silver sound. This pulled him forward a little, only a little, out of the bracken, and their side-slit eyes caught sight of him, and the wagon rumbled forward as they bolted. The tiger, finding his instincts, slammed open, was up and running, a full rush of blood already in his chest as he cleared the wagon and sprang for the hindquarters of the ox on the right. He had him for a moment, claws ripping into the hips and his teeth on the thick base of the tail. But then there was the harness and the cart and the other ox, and somewhere in the confusion, something struck him in the ribs, and he let go and dropped away and was left behind, watching the cart's wavering path until it came to rest beyond the clearing. The hunter was nowhere in sight. My grandfather should have been comforted by Daurisha's departure. But he awoke that night, after hours of half-dreams, with hysteria raging through his bloodstream in the dark. Sitting up in bed, he could not rid himself of the feeling that something had shifted, crawled between himself and the tiger and the tiger's wife, until the distances between them, which he had slowly and carefully been closing, had gone back to something insurmountable. The idea of the walk to her house alone exhausted him. The sky was cloudless, and the moon made shadows on the floor by his bed. The fire was already dead, embers breathing on the hearth. He got up and slipped into his boots and his coat, and like that, in his nightshirt, his head bare, he went outside and ran through town, the wind biting his face and fingers. There was no light in the village. All around him, the pasture was shining with new snow. Somewhere behind, a dog was barking, and another dog took up the call, and their voices rang to each other in the dark. The weight of the afternoon snowfall had freed the slanted shoulders of her roof, piled the hedges thick and uneven, and my grandfather stood at the bottom of the porch steps and stared up at the black attic turret and the black windows. The house seemed strange to him, unfamiliar, and he could not summon a memory of being indoors with the tiger's wife. He could see that something had crossed the stairs and the porch, leaving white furrows behind. He tried to tell himself that perhaps the tiger had done this in coming home, but the footprints were small, the trails short and two-footed, and they led away from the door. He thought about going up, letting himself in, waiting for her by the hearth. But the house was empty, and he would be alone. My grandfather ran down to the end of the pasture and under the fence, following the trail, which was becoming deeper as the snow thickened out in the field. All winter he had not come this far, and now, with the snow groaning under his boots, he ran blindly forward, his breath beating wide clouds that fanned out around him. His eyes were watering with the cold. At the edge of the field, the ground dipped down into a stream bed, where he got stuck briefly among the icy rocks, and then began to slope upward sharply through the thickets at the lip of the forest. The tracks were heavy with hesitation here, and they made twisted, uneven holes in the places where her coat and hair had snagged, forcing her to swivel to free herself, or where the trees had come up quickly and into her eyes. My grandfather kept his head low and reached for the boughs of saplings, pulling himself up, exhausted already, but urging himself on and on. Snow, piled thick in the high silence of the pines, slapped down on him as he went. His hands were raw, and he was choking on his own fear, on his inability to move faster, on the urgency of his own disbelief. Perhaps the house would stay dark forever. Perhaps she had gone away for good. He fell, once, twice, and each time he went down into the snow, suddenly much deeper than it seemed. And when he came up, his nostrils were full, and he had to wipe the sting out of his eyes. He did not know how much farther he had to go. Perhaps the tiger's wife had left hours before. Perhaps she had already met the tiger somewhere far ahead in the woods, and the two of them had gone ahead into the winter, leaving him behind. And what if the stories were not as false and ridiculous as he had previously thought? What if, by the same magic that made him a man, the tiger had changed the girl into a tiger as well? What if my grandfather stumbled onto the two of them and she did not remember him? As my grandfather went, arm over arm, his heart making sour little shudders against his ribs, he kept listening for a sound, the sound of the tiger, the sound of anything but his own feet and lungs. He was pulling himself up, 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 where the roots of trees made a curve over what looked like the lip of a hill. Then he was standing in a clearing, and he saw them. There, where the trees sloped briefly down onto a cradle in the side of the mountain, the tiger's wife, still herself, still human, shoulders draped with hair, was kneeling with an armful of meat. The tiger was nowhere in sight, but there was someone else in the clearing, 15 or 20 feet behind her, and my grandfather's relief at finding the girl was overwhelmed now by the realization that this unexpected figure, changing before his eyes from man to shadow and back again, was Darisha the bear, enormous and upright, advancing through the snow with a gun on his arm. My grandfather wanted to shout a warning, but he stumbled forward instead, breathless, his arms high to pull himself out of the snow. The tiger's wife heard nothing. She was kneeling quietly in the glade, digging. And then Darisha the bear was on her. My grandfather saw him grab the tiger's wife and pull her to her feet, and already she was thrashing like an animal in a head snare. Darisha had her by the shoulder, and her body was arching forward, away from him, her free arm jerking over her head to claw at his face and his hair, and all the while she was making a hoarse, rasping sound, like a cough, and my grandfather could hear her teeth clacking hard together. She was enormous and clumsy. And then Darisha stumbled forward and pushed her into the snow, and she fell and disappeared. And my grandfather couldn't see her in the darkness, but he was still running. Then Darisha was getting to his knees, and my grandfather put his hands out and shouted, one long, endless howl of fear and hatred and despair, and launched himself onto Darisha's shoulders and bit his ear. Darisha did not react as quickly as you might expect, probably because, for a moment, he may have thought the tiger was on him. Then he must have realized that something small and human was gnawing on his ear, and he reached around, and my grandfather hung on and on until Darisha finally caught hold of my grandfather's coat and peeled him off with one arm, off and onto the ground. My grandfather lay stunned. Above him, the trees were steep and sharp and lost in the darkness, and the sounds around his head vanished in the snow. Then the furious face of Darisha the bear, neck dark with blood, and weight coming down on my grandfather's chest, Darisha's knee or elbow. And then, before he even knew what was happening, my grandfather's hand was closing on something cold and hard it contacted in the snow and raising it straight up against Darisha's nose. There was a crack and a sudden burst of blood, and then Darisha fell forward over my grandfather and lay still. My grandfather did not get up. He lay there, the coarse hairs of Darisha's coat in his mouth, and he listened to the dull thud of a heartbeat, unsure whether it was his own or Darisha's. And then the blood-brown, sticky hands of the tiger's wife rolled the man over and pulled my grandfather to his feet. She was ashen, the skin beneath her eyes tight and gray with fear, and she was turning his face this way and that, uselessly bundling him deeper into his coat. And then my grandfather was running again. The tiger's wife was running beside him, gripping his hand like she might fall. She was breathing hard and fast, small sounds that lodged in her throat. My grandfather hoped she might call to the tiger somehow, but he didn't know how. And he didn't know whether he was supposed to be holding her hand or the other way around. He knew with certainty that he could run faster, but the tiger's wife had her other arm across her belly, so he kept pace with her, her bundled-up body, and her bare feet, and he held her fingers tight. You've been listening to The Tiger's Wife, a 2011 novel by Thea Obret, published by Random House. We'll have more next time on Chapter a Day.